तिथे वासुदेवाय नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 21, Conversation between Manu and Kadama, text number 4. Tasyam Savai Mahayogi Yuktayam Yoga Lakshanai Sasajja Katidha Viryam Tanme Susushabhevada Tasyam Savai Mahayogi Yuktayam Yoga Lakshanai Sasajya Katidha Viryam Tanme Susushabhevada Tasyam Savai Mahayogi Yuktayam Yoga Lakshanai Sasajya Katida Viryam Tanme Susushabhevada Tasyam In her Sa Kadama Muni Vai In fact, Mahayogi, great mystic yogi, Yuktayam, endowed Yoga Lakshanai, with the eightfold systems of yogic perfection, Sasajha, propagated, Katida. How many times? Viryam, offspring. That narration. Me. To me. Sususeve. Who am eager to hear. Vada. Tell. Translation. How many offspring did that great yogi beget through the princess who is endowed with eightfold perfection in the yoga principles? Oh, pray tell me this, for I am eager to hear it. Purport by Sivan Grace A.C. Here, Vidura inquired about Kadama Muni and his wife, Devahuti, and about their children. It is described here that Devahuti was very much advanced in the performance of Eightfold Yoga. The eight divisions of yoga performance are described as control of the senses, strict following of the rules and regulations, practice of the different sitting postures, control of the breath, withdrawing the senses from sense objects, concentration of the mind, meditation and self-realization. After self-realization, there are eight further perfection stages which are called yoga siddhis. The husband and wife, Kadama Muni and Devahuti, were advanced in yoga practice. The husband was a Mahayogi, great mystic, and the wife was a Yoga Lakshana, or one advanced in yoga. They united and produced children. Formerly, after making their lives perfect, great sages and saintly persons used to beget children. Otherwise, they strictly observed the rules and regulations of celibacy. Brahmacharya, following the rules and regulations of celibacy, is required for perfection of self-realization and mystic power. There is Vidyam Yoga Lakshanai to Sajjat Vidyam and Mesha Susha Devana. How many offspring did that great yogi beget through the princess who was endowed with eightfold perfection in yoga principles? O pray, tell me this, for I am eager to hear it. So, the doer is inquiring from Maitreya a little further about the line of descendants coming from Swayambhuva Manu. Swayambhuva Manu, of course, is the first Manu in this day of Brahma, and we are now in the Manu of Vairasvata Manu, the seventh Manu. So this is going back to the first Manu, and that Manu lives, Swayambhuva Manu, as with each of the Manus, they live for 71 cycles of the four yugas. Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali. And this is at the very beginning, so within the Satya Yuga, at the beginning of Swayambhuva Manu's rule. So the inquiry is that his daughter Devahuti was married with Kadama Muni. So he's asking about how many offspring, who were those children that were born from that union. And that's very significant, of course, because Kadama Muni was a Mahayogi. So he was endowed to a great degree with the perfections in the yoga cities, the eight perfections, and his wife Devahuti was also a great yogi, Yoga Lakshana, and she was also very advanced in the eight practices of yoga. So their children, of course, you know, are very significant. Because these children are born from parents who follow the Vedic process of attaining perfection before they begin to have children. Of course, those considerations are not followed today. The considerations today, at best, we see, at least in, you know, generally, some civilizations still have some family planning, and you know, at least a couple marry, and then they have children, and then even after marriage, you know, generally there's some. You know, they may have some considerations that perhaps you may get a house or, you know, some employment or, you know, increase the bank balance or something. So usually there's some financial arrangements that's probably the best that's made. And of course, you know, in this day and age, that is considered the perfection. You know, to have a nice home, car, job, and you've reached perfection, and you know, you can have children. Okay. So here, of course, people don't follow that anymore. You know, if children are born, in many cases the children are unplanned, and then the question is, you know, shall we keep the child, or, you know, shall we, you know, abort the child? child or kill the child. So, you know, it's right down at the bottom of the scale of things in the thought process when it comes to children. So therefore, the inquiry about the children from this union of Kadama Muni and Devadutti is very, very significant, very important. It's, the highest standards that are possible. So, the main aspect here, because as has been described in previous verses, that one may question that someone on the spiritual path, the path of self-realization, the path of God-realization, what is their interest in hearing about family life? And but the questions here, the questions pertain not so much to the details of the sex life, which they understood. There's been celibacy and complete control of the senses, but the question pertains to how many children, and who were those children that were born from this extraordinary match of these two great yogis like that. And again, generally when people inquire about family life these days, they're actually more interested in the sex life. That's their inquiries, they have a couple of beers and they talk about the sex life. So most of this is very uncommon, extremely uncommon. The whole question, the couple, the process of getting children is very uncommon. It's so uncommon, in fact, that it's so extraordinary that for most people who would hear this question and these stories would consider it some myth. It just didn't happen. That's how extraordinary, that's how rare it is that two yogis got married and had children after becoming perfect in the eight mystic yogic cities, and after a long time of penances and austerities and yoga and meditation, if people hear this story, they'll just consider it's just a story, it just didn't happen. So extraordinary is this. But actually, so therefore, when you consider this is actually history, this happened, therefore, it is quite wonderful. Therefore, you can understand that those persons of very refined spiritual mentality of great consciousness, they would ask these questions. Just like we might inquire about Srila Prabhupada's children. Here's another. Srila Prabhupada or his family life. Srila Prabhupada, of course, is also considered to be a Nitya Siddha, or even on a higher level of self and God realization than even Gautama Muni and Devahuti at this stage. So what is the nature of that person who comes from the spiritual world and has children? In Christianity, there are some difficulties, because there's the archaeological history of the life of Jesus, and written documents, they have like the, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Mini Scrolls and what have you, which describe that he was married, he had children, and there's a bloodline like that. And of course, you know, we have the different movies, but actually originally the various movies come out as a book written by a series of books written by persons who are writing a story for the BBC, and they discovered that people were trying to keep this bloodline from Jesus and Mary Magdalene through the ages, with the hope that one day they would, if they could establish someone from that bloodline back on the in some position of power, that they would really be able to you know, have quite an influence in the world of politics. That you know, who can go against this person? He's coming in the line of Jesus, like that. And and of course, in those days, to be a priest, it was unheard of not to be married. You know, if you were a priest in those days, they were all married. It would be really strange not to be married and to be, you know, a senior, you know, priest with a ministry in those days. So they have they have the history, but of course, for the those who apparently wanted to, you know, take certain parts of the Gospels and the histories and create the Bible, you know, it's again, it's a historical fact that certain things are left out, certain things are included in, and there's a whole controversy about that. Why did they put this in? Why didn't they put that in? So, and it appears that you know, the picture we get is that Jesus sort of just dropped out of the sky. There's no family, there's no background, or because that would sort of make him a person in this material world. So therefore, we, you know, we can sort of, you know, blank out all that family background and history, which makes him look like an ordinary person who has a family and has children and has sex life. It's, then he appears to be a real saint because he's sort of just floated down from the spiritual world and just dropped out of the sky. But there's a whole controversy which is sort of, you know, causing a lot of difficulty. So for the majority of people who investigate, you know, Christianity, that's the part that they accept, just the historical, you know, facts where things are well documented. Because actually, at that time in history, it's one of the most documented times in history because of the nature of, you know, where that place was, which was, you know, the crossroads of the, you know, the trade routes and very important, you know, events in history. So it's one of the most documented times in history. And so. And the interesting thing in that BBC documentary was that that history, when these reporters presented that to the clergy, the leaders, they already accepted it. Yes, we know that history and we accept it, but they didn't want to present it to the followers, because it disturbed them. So it wasn't a revelation amongst the leaders of Christianity. It was something to be kept away from the masses, who they thought may not understand. So, and here also, you know, we're looking at the life of Kadama Muni and Devahuti. And, you know, for those who have a proper understanding of the knowledge of great saintly personalities and even avatars, it's not out of context for them to be married and to be having children. In fact, it's actually perfectly natural. And, you know, personalities like Swami Vivekananda, All the Manus are considered avatars. One of the six different types of avatars. The Manvantara avatars, all the Manus, are empowered to oversee literally the population of mankind and other living entities, and to rule over. So for 71 yugas, 71 divi yugas, cycles of yugas, so they're empowered. And then within their entire period, there are also other avatars who appear, who are also accepted as avatars in the sense that they appear within those periods of month. So they're actually considered incarnations of the Lord, or empowered incarnations of the Lord. So not only, it would be extraordinary to think, well, these great perfect personalities who are engaged in family life, it's very difficult to understand that they are empowered sacred persons, but they can also be empowered avatars, which is even more difficult to understand. But so, and just like Srila Prabhupada, we see that by Krishna's arrangement, that we have the great Acharya, who was also Grihastha. Children. He married. His wife was very young. She was very young. I think she was about 8 years old or something like that. She was quite young. And Prabhupada tells different stories sometimes in his lectures that I think she had her first child when she was 13. He tells some, not a lot, because he's sannyasi. Sannyasis generally don't reflect on their marriage, the previous marriage. But in order for us to understand certain important points, we sometimes reflect that he gives an example of how bhakti, in some respects, or sometimes even the relationship with spiritual master, in some respects, there's some parallels in the way a Vedic marriage would take place. That Prabhupada mentioned when he was first, he was introduced to his wife, so she was a little girl, and he was an adult. So when he held her hands, he started crying. And, so you can see, and of course, in modern days, of course, there's this love at first sight, or, there's this strange thing, meet someone, lights are going to go off, and stars are going to start flying out of each other's eyes, and, knees are going to go walking, what have you. And, the relationship is considered to be compatible, but it actually grows from a very immature stage, actually, in marriage. And we will see that with the marriage of Devahuti and Kadama Muni, how the relationship matures. But Prabhupada also mentioned that story because, again, with even medically, the medical profession, they recommend having children, at some late age, 25, 28, for women. And somehow, that if women have children at a young age, it's highly dangerous and bad for their health and some things like that. But actually, for thousands of years, it was the complete opposite, that the younger, when children because the mothers are, you know, quite young and playful, full of energy, and the children are young, playful, you know, full of energy. So, you know, the mothers can run around with 3 or 4 or 5 children, you know, all day long, and they've got just as much energy as the children. Yeah, you know, because these days they're having children, the mothers are about 25, 28, 32, 33. You know, and getting through one day with a child is such an age difference. So, you know, the mother's lost their playful ability and what have you, even the ability to, you know, communicate with the child. And, you know, they're quite happy just to, I'll put you in a crèche, you know, all day, I'll go to work, and then they come home to work, and, you know, they might have someone else to look after. There's no energy, you know, and even the enthusiasm, and they struggle. But Srila Prabhupada tells us a little bit about his family life because you can see how things, you know, Prabhupada's life is, you know, quite extraordinary because he lived in the era, you know, pretty much the last phases almost of Indian culture just sort of disappeared. But it was still quite as strong, you know, as he describes his mother. You know, she wouldn't go out on the street, you know, just, you know, walk out the street, head uncovered, like that. She went somewhere, she carried a pumpkin and everything covered up. So, you know, very chaste, you know, woman, like that. And so, you know, you get also a little inclination of just how chaste the women. The closest I ever saw to that sort of, I'd say, modesty in public, when I was in Tasmania, and I went to visit some friends, and the mother of the friends drove us into the main street. We were going to buy something. She just lit up a cigarette in the car. And then as soon as she got out of the car, she put it out. And I said, you just lit that up. And he, you know, I'm not going to walk across the street with a cigarette. Shameful. So, that was about as close, you know, as I've ever seen, you know, some concept of modesty in public. But, you know, it took, you know, even that, I was shocked by her principles. You know, gee, I said, that's, she's got a lot of principles. Because, you know, now it's, they're all walking around like Lady Gaga. So, therefore, when you get a proper picture of spiritual life, you know, marriage is, you know, just a normal part of it. Strangely enough, although that's within our philosophy, and as we say, generally, you know, people, when they think of spiritual life, they think it's somehow or another spiritual. stick. So he's a Westerner. He had a stick, a little, cloth, and all his belongings tied to the end of the stick. He walked around barefoot. He had no family. And people considered him to be highly spiritual because of that. No home, no family, no possessions. Therefore, you are a great subject for that. But I knew this person, and he was absorbed in sex life day and night. He was a complete opposite. He lived like an animal. And even people knew of his, lusty nature. Still, just because of the fact that they didn't consider that a problem. It didn't, they didn't think, oh, how could he be saying that he was just a lusty, person? It didn't enter their minds. He had no family, he had no shoes, he had no possession. He was just fine. And, in Islam, we've had a few anomalies where, in the early days, sometimes devotees, even after reading Srimad Bhagavatam, what have you, because we come to the movement with some baggage and concepts in our heart. We come with some. And so sometimes that, those concepts which we have before becoming a devotee can last for many, many years. There was one picture that stands out in my mind was I was doing Padi Yatra in New Zealand. We used to travel from one country town to the next, especially the main ones, and we would hold a big festival, and 200-500 people, give them bishar, and have big kirtan, big dancing, plays, discussion like that. And in between, we used to camp by the river, we'd camp by the ocean, and you'd have a couple of hundred devotees, a very, very nice association. But when you get a lot of devotees like that, sometimes some like to give a bit more attention. You put some people in the crowd, they like the central attention. You should understand how much I'm a great devotee like that. Travel with me a little bit, you'll gradually see. I remember, one morning I was in the tent, it was after morning travel, and I was in the tent, and I heard this little child, little boy, screaming his head off. It was like he was in pain or agony. Because there's so many devotees around, I thought, someone's going to tend to that child. But it went on, and I thought, surely there's so many devotees around, someone would tend to that child. But they didn't, and he just kept screaming. I thought, So I went out and I walked across the field, and I saw that the father of this child, the child was about, maybe 1.5 years, maybe a little bit more than that. And he was, so this very early in the morning, New Zealand, cold, frost was still melting on the grass, and he's giving him this cold bath, not just once, but, just for a long time, and kids like just screaming his head off, And I said to him, "What are you doing?" So he was thinking, that this is a good example that he will learn detachment. He will learn detachment, and I'm detached. I'm not going to get into those feelings, and cut him or anything like that. He's going to, like that. So, there's a lot of strange little things like that. But that's, just shows you. And that sort of thing was there for many years. Even now, we do see, not that extreme, this one's very much better now, but sometimes, you can see that. Sometimes you see it a little bit when devotees may leave, the brahmacharya or the brahmacharya you know, perfection in devotional service. You want the man and the woman to, you know, be really fixed up on the spiritual path before they have children. So it's the same principle as what is followed here with Kadam, and exactly the same principle. Because then you have good children, and if they properly understand the Srimad Bhagavatam, the relationship between your husband and wife is very nice as well. They'll get along nicely because they have good qualities. As we said, for women also, you want them to, you know, be fixed up in devotional service, but there is the consideration that how long will they wait before they have children. So that has to be there. So, you know, there's some, that's why there's not a discrimination. It's, you know, quite a natural factor. In one part of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada talks about you know, compatibilities. And he describes there that, you know, his understanding is that, you know, if the husband and wife are both Krishna conscious, they'll get along. That Krishna consciousness creates the compatibility because they get all the good qualities. From what I understand, compatibilities are important because, you know, if the Krishna consciousness wanes and they're also incompatible, you may have a big problem at that stage. You know, if one of the partners, you know, their Krishna consciousness, you know, significantly decreases and falls away, and it can create a great strain in the relationship. At least if there's a compatibility, they'll still remain husband and wife and just go on one sort of, you know, maybe fully engaged and others sort of lost their interest. In. So the compatibility, you know, they're like a safety net. But above everything, you know, the Krishna consciousness is, you know, paramount. So that, you know, the community from the the priests, you know, all the various, you know, the teachers, you know, different adults, older children, like that. They all, you know, people teaching art, people teaching music, you know, everyone looking after the children, understanding that the children within the community are these great souls who, according to the Bhagavad Gita, and as Srila Prabhupada emphasizes, you know, we have to see them. They're very, very special birth, very, very special children, and they have an opportunity. They're so elevated that because of that birth, practically that this lifetime can be their last. They're just so close to going back to Godhead. And if they're looked after, then, you know, that opportunity can be given. And of course, if the parents are struggling in their Krishna consciousness or, you know, laying along, sometimes the children, they grow up to be such nice devotees that they actually, you know, dragging the parents along behind them, you know. You see that sometimes, the children just take the parents like, you know, the Krishna consciousness, a little bit mild, and this child takes birth in the family and just, you know, picks them up and, you know, drags them back to Godhead with them. So these topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam concerning the family life, we should take this with great interest, as just as we take every single topic, every single verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. So I might just leave it there and just see at this stage if anyone has any comments or questions. Sometimes, you know, but it varies. You know, you see with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu on a slightly, you know, different note, but sometimes he would experience transcendental ecstasy. In other words, he was absorbed in his affectionate relationship with the Supreme Lord. But in certain company, he would just, you know, stop all that external, symptoms that he was experiencing as a result of that transcendental affection, because he understood that it would disturb the minds of others. We have a similar thing with the holy name. So we have to be definitely mindful of that. But, you know, in various circumstances. So in other words, you know, if you're with, the brahmacharis, the sannyasis, vanaprastha, there's certainly greater restrictions. Then it depends who that sannyasi is. Because some of the sannyasis, you know, are not as bothered as others. And it depends also on the, you know, maturity of the brahmacharya sometimes, you know. Some become extremely bold other times. I remember in Perth, I was there in 1980, and up until that, with the first of us, Upananda, Prabhupada disciple, we were trying to start that temple there. Then there was Ganesh. After Ganesh left, there was Purushottam, and so he became temple president. We got a new building, big building, and so he was a long-standing friend of mine. He was a Grihastha, I was a Grihastha, and we were Sankirtan devotees, and we'd known each other. When he became temple president, he pulled me into the office one day, let's say, sat me in the hot seat. He was younger. He had some disturbing comments. I said, what have I done? You've been showing affection to your wife in the temple. Because, you know, my partner, my first partner, was just a very jovial sort of person. Laughed a lot. So, you know, we joked a lot together. And but that joking together was taken as a very serious problem. And like that. And I was really shocked because actually, you know, up until one day before, there was never a comment. But as soon as you become an authority, it was a comment. And I don't know why it changed. It actually, the friendship stopped there. Okay. So, but I understood, you know, okay, gee, you know, now I have to, he's a friend. We've been just acting normally together as creative couples for so long. Now it stopped. So, then I had to stop. So, you know, if there's some disturbance, at the same time, you know, we're a preaching movement. You know, someone comes to the temple and they say, you know, gee, these families, I wouldn't want to be Hare Krishna. It's like, God, you should see the way they, you know, don't sit together and look at each other as if they're, you know, untouchables, and, you know, they treat their children like, you know, something that's picked up out of the garden. You know, it's not very, you know, it's not real attractive preaching like that. You know, sometimes for the sake of, so therefore if you're with people and, you know, we're doing something, you know, quite strange, you know, it will drive them away. If people think they can't be part of Islam and have a normal family life, they won't be interested at all. They'll say, well, so, you know, there's a consideration if we're too harsh. And we have had that. It is actually a criticism. There used to be it got to the point in the early days where we were, had such a bad reputation for that sort of level of lack of affection and unity within families, that the deprogrammers took advantage of it and spread these, you know, horrific stories about us, and the general public accepted quite easily because of our bad reputation and what people saw. So they were saying, oh, you know, they want their kids to chant Hare Krishna, you know, they'll tie them up by the toes and hang them over the balcony, and then the public's like, oh, I can see them doing that. the children themselves. You know, children just, you know, they're not like, you know, you get a 5-year-old child is thinking, oh, you know, well, mum and dad don't touch me because it's there in the back of the tongue. Oh, I understand that. No, they're not going to, you know. By the time they're 15 and they've worked out what their parents have been reading in the Bhagavad Gita, that's why they never really gave them the cover. They lost them. You know. As Prabhupada says, for children, you know, up until the age of 5, basically you've shown heaps of love. Cover, affection. You know, at the age of 5, he says that you introduce discipline. And learn to, and show them how that discipline can be fun and joyful. From the age of 10, you know, to 15, 16, you become very strict, the most strict. That's when they, you know, all the rebelliousness comes out, but you've somehow got to, you know, really protect them from themselves. You know, children going through that stage get very confused. And they sort of want to be adults, but they're really still just children. So you've got to protect them because they want to do all the things that adults do and they've really got no idea what they're doing. So, you know, you're quite strict. Very firm. More firm than you've ever been. And then he says when they get 15 or 16, you treat them like a parent. So, but... So, you know, that affection, especially in those first 5 years. So, you know, in those first 5 years, showing a lot of affection, and that means physically also, hugs and cuddles for children, then if it sort of reduces after that, it's like they don't feel, you know, they understand, no, they love me, I know that. But if it hasn't been there in that time, as they get to 5, then they're confused. And then is it when they become like that? So, you know, there are many different considerations. But you'll find that, you know, as we, that's why these books are so important. Srila Prabhupada's books and his lectures on these and his room conversations where he refers to these. Because if we, as Prabhupada says, cram his purports and his lectures, then all of these various considerations will make you, you know, a well-rounded devotee to be able to, because one may think, oh, these subject matters are for grihasthas. But, you know, it's a very nice question you've asked, because actually the brahmacharis also, and the sannyasis, also have to understand the same teaching. Because they're dealing with grihasthas and they're preaching to family people. I remember one time in Sydney, I was standing with a godbrother of mine who was a brahmachari. We were at a wedding and our spiritual master was doing the wedding along the street of Lard, and this brahmachari came up to me and he's on the beat now. I'm not hanging around this wedding. It's a wedding, I'm a brahmachari. I'll see you later. And I said, there's nothing to do. Your spiritual master's about 2 meters away, you can't find anything to do here. Your spiritual master's right there, you can't find any service to do. Your spiritual master, it's just really impractical. You know, this philosophy is for everyone. And the grihasthas, the brahmacharis, the sannyasis, the vanaprasthas, the women and the men, we all read this wholeheartedly and soak up every bit of transmission. Not that we skip, I'll leave that section for Dharma on that. Let's get to the Natalog introduction. Yeah, so, you know, we for preaching purposes and for being able to interact with each other, and because, you know, in the long run, of course, you know, some ground charities will, may eventually become greenhouses, so it's good to have a proper understanding. And of course, we, as we said, we have so many children, so we all have to interact with them like that. So they're very important. So nice person. Any other questions? Yeah, well, that's so. As Prabhupada mentions, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, therefore, you can do an astrological compatibility. Yeah. And if that's not available, then there can be, a compatibility by persons, mature persons who are intimately related with, the man and the woman, who know their natures really well. That's another way to do it. So if you don't have the astrological compatibility, sometimes the spiritual master, who may know his disciples really well, or other senior devotees, sometimes they can, if they have a good relationship over a long period of time, in various different circumstances, they can tell. But still, there are some things which are seen astrologically which can't be seen otherwise. And, there are advantages. So you can have a compatibility with someone, and yet that person may leave their body a year after you're married. So you may not marry that person. But how do you see that? Prabhupada gives this example. In one of his conversations, he described that there was a friend of his who was a doctor, so he was the family's doctor, and he was quite a famous doctor. He had a very good reputation. So he was treating a person who had this throat problem. There was bleeding and all sorts of things, and it was very serious. It was almost like the person would die. And the person wasn't responding to the treatment, and it looked very, very serious. So Prabhupada's doctor said to him, "See an astrologer." So he went and saw the astrologer, and the astrologer said, "Oh, you're being treated for the wrong disease. You don't have that, you have this." So he went back to the doctor, and the doctor took the astrologer's advice, treated him for a different disease, and he recovered. But Prabhupada tells that story. Prabhupada had a lot of, dismissive remarks about astrology, because generally it is one of the most misused sciences there is. And especially, it's very hard to understand its relationship between astrology and devotional service. And he didn't want the devotees to become confused or entangled in bad astrological advice. Not be completely fixed up on the path of surrender to Krishna and be taking shelter of other things in the material sense. That doesn't mean that astrology doesn't have a spiritual application. Chaitanya Charitamrita is a story of an astrologer who went to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and asked him if he could do an astrological reading for him. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wasn't so interested, but he said, "Yeah, okay." And the astrologer looked, he said, "I don't quite understand my calculations here, because I see that you are the absolute truth. I don't know, what's happening." So anyway, there was some conversation, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describes in that purport, and in that section by Srila Prabhupada, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted that astrological reading as a devotional service in pure devotional service according to his occupation. And he awarded that astrologer prema bhakti and he went back to Godhead. So, you know, everything. You know, I mean, Arjuna was a warrior, he was killing people. You know, so the unusual, so he can kill people, but he can't do an astrological compatibility to people who married. So everything has an application. But, you know, first and foremost, because we're under the shelter of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you know, if the person's guiding the couples for Krishna conscious, and the couples become Krishna conscious, then everything should be okay. So we don't depend upon anything else except what is Prabhupada's giving. We're not dependent. If other things are there, we can take advantage of. But we're only dependent upon Krishna, Srila Prabhupada's teachings, the Holy Name. But we don't reject things artificially. You know, if they're there, okay. If they're not, doesn't matter. That's right, and then there's the, you know, the detachment as a result of you know, one's great love for Krishna. That one is not in a relationship for one's own personal pleasure, but that relationship is because it's a way to please Krishna through devotional service. Then there's detachment. That because he was a person of high caliber, it was natural. natural for him to have, you know, affection for everyone, you know. And he was very, very sad to see that he had to, you know, kill these people on the battlefield. So, but what Srila Prabhupada pointed out was this, that it's natural, you know, to have all the normal affections to your son, you know, whether you're an eternal nitya siddha like Arjuna, Srila Prabhupada, or, you know, what to speak of others, it is natural to have feelings for other sentient beings and living beings. But what he said was that Arjuna, you know, he lost his composure. He's very, very disturbed at the loss of his son. But then, because he was a great devotee, because he had such, you know, high, great spiritual strength, because he was so attached to Krishna, he wasn't going to let Krishna down. Even he lost his son, it hurt him so much, but I still have to win this battle for Krishna. Even at the cost of my son, you know, he didn't like it. He's not like, oh, I'm doing devotional service, and my son couldn't give. I don't give it, you know, I don't give it. No, it hurt him. But he quickly composed his nature and won that battle. And that's the difference between a devotee, that they have all the same range of emotions. And, you know, it really disturbs them when things happen to other devotees or any living being. You know. But because they're devotees and they're of high, you know, spiritual consciousness, they quickly compose their character and, you know, get on with what has to be done nonetheless. So that's the difference. Yeah. So it's not artificial devotees, it's not artificial. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada, after speaking that, you know, he said, you know, basically, Arjuna was not acting ridiculously, but you were speaking ridiculously. So we don't want to speak ridiculously. Any other comments or questions? We always stick very close to, you know, there's so much. Everything is there. Back in